Part 1. The Adventure of the Hero. Chapter 1. Departure. 1. The Call to Adventure.
Long, long ago, when wishing still could lead to something, there lived a king whose daughters all were beautiful, but the youngest was so beautiful that the sun itself, who had seen so many things, simply marveled every time it shone on her face. Now, close to the castle of this king was a great dark forest, and in the forest, under an old lime tree, a spring. And when the day was very hot, the king's child would go out into the wood and sit on the edge of the cool spring. And to pass the time, she would take a golden ball, toss it up and catch it, and this was her favorite plaything. Now it so happened one day that the golden ball of the princess did not fall into the little hand lifted into the air, but passed it, bounced on the ground, and rolled directly into the water. The princess followed it with her eyes, but the ball disappeared. And the spring was deep, so deep that the bottom could not be seen. Thereupon she began to cry, and her crying became louder and louder, and she was unable to find consolation. And while she was lamenting in this way, she heard someone call to her, "What is the matter, princess? You are crying so hard, a stone would be forced to pity you." She looked around to see where the voice had come from, and there she beheld a frog holding its fat, ugly head out of the water. "Oh, it's you, old water plopper," she said. "I am crying over my golden ball, which has fallen into the spring." "Be calm, don't cry," answered the frog. "I can surely be of assistance. But what will you give me if I fetch your toy for you?" "Whatever you like to have, dear frog," she said. "My clothes, my pearls and jewels, even the golden crown that I wear." The frog replied, "Your clothes, your pearls and jewels, and your golden crown I do not want. But if you will care for me and let me be your companion and playmate, let me sit beside you at your little table, eat from your little golden plate, drink from your little cup, sleep in your little bed. If you will promise me that, I will go straight down and fetch your golden ball." "All right," she said. "I promise you anything you want if you will only bring me back the ball." But, she thought, "How that simple frog chatters! There he sits in the water with his own kind and could never be the companion of a human being." As soon as the frog had obtained her promise, he ducked his head and sank. And after a little while, came swimming up again. He had the ball in his mouth and tossed it on the grass. The princess was elated when she saw her pretty toy. She picked it up and scampered away. "Wait! Wait," called the frog. "Take me along. I can't run like you." But what good did it do, though he croaked after her as loudly as he could? She paid not the slightest heed, but hurried home, and soon had completely forgotten the poor frog, who must have hopped back again into his spring.
This is an example of one of the ways in which the adventure can begin. A blunder, apparently the merest chance, reveals an unsuspected world, and the individual is drawn into a relationship with forces that are not rightly understood. As Freud has shown, blunders are not the merest chance. They are the result of suppressed desires and conflicts. They are ripples on the surface of life produced by unsuspected springs. And these may be very deep as the soul itself. The blunder may amount to the opening of a destiny. Thus it happens in this fairy tale that the disappearance of the ball is the first sign of something coming for the princess, the frog is the second, and the unconsidered promise is the third. As a preliminary manifestation of the powers that are breaking into play, the frog, coming up as it were by miracle, can be termed the herald. The crisis of his appearance is the call to adventure. The herald's summons may be to live, as in the present instance, or, at a later moment of the biography, to die. It may sound the call to some high historical undertaking. Or it may mark the dawn of religious illumination. As apprehended by the mystic, it marks what has been termed the awakening of the self. In the case of the princess of the fairy tale, it signified no more than the coming of adolescence. But whether small or great, and no matter what the stage or grade of life, the call rings up the curtain, always, on a mystery of transfiguration, a rite or moment of spiritual passage which, when complete, amounts to a dying and a birth. The familiar life horizon has been outgrown. The old concepts, ideals, and emotional patterns no longer fit. The time for the passing of a threshold is at hand. Typical of the circumstances of the call are the dark forest, the great tree, the babbling spring, and the loathly, underestimated appearance of the carrier of the power of destiny. We recognize in the scene the symbols of the world navel. The frog, the little dragon, is the nursery counterpart of the underworld serpent whose head supports the earth and who represents the life-progenitive, demiurgic powers of the abyss. He comes up with the golden sunball, his dark, deep waters having just taken it down, at this moment resembling the great Chinese dragon of the East, delivering the rising sun in his jaws, or the frog on whose head rides the handsome young immortal, Han Xiang, carrying in a basket the peaches of immortality. Freud has suggested that all moments of anxiety reproduce the painful feelings of the first separation from the mother, the tightening of the breath, congestion of the blood, etc., of the crisis of birth. Conversely, all moments of separation and new birth produce anxiety. Whether it be the king's child about to be taken from the felicity of her established dual unity with King Daddy, or God's daughter Eve, now ripe to depart from the idol of the garden, or again the supremely concentrated future Buddha breaking past the last horizons of the created world, the same archetypal images are activated, symbolizing danger, reassurance, trial, passage, and the strange holiness of the mysteries of birth. The disgusting and rejected frog or dragon of the fairy tale brings up the sunball in its mouth. For the frog, the serpent, the rejected one, is the representative of that unconscious deep, so deep that the bottom cannot be seen, wherein are hoarded all of the rejected, unadmitted, unrecognized, unknown, or undeveloped factors, laws, and elements of existence. Those are the pearls of the fabled submarine palaces of the Nixies, Tritons, and Water Guardians, the jewels that give light to the demon cities of the underworld, the fire seeds in the ocean of immortality, which supports the earth and surrounds it like a snake. The stars in the bosom of immortal night. Those are the nuggets in the gold hoard of the dragon, the guarded apples of the Hesperides, the filaments of the golden fleece. The herald or announcer of the adventure, therefore, is often dark, loathly, or terrifying, judged evil by the world. Yet, if one could follow, the way would be opened through the walls of day into the dark, where the jewels glow. Or the herald is a beast, as in the fairy tale, representative of the repressed instinctual fecundity within ourselves. Or again, a veiled mysterious figure, the unknown. The story is told, for example, of King Arthur, and how he made him ready with many knights to ride a hunting.
As soon as he was in the forest, the king saw a great hart afore him. "This hart will I chase," said King Arthur, and so he spurred the horse, and rode after long, and so by fine force he was like to have smitten the hart. Whereas the king had chased the hart so long that his horse lost his breath and fell down dead. Then a yeoman fetched the king another horse. So the king saw the hart embushed, and his horse dead. He set him down by a fountain, and there he fell in great thoughts. And as he sat so, him thought he heard a noise of hounds, to the sum of 30. And with that the king saw, coming toward him, the strangest beast that ever he saw or heard of. So the beast went to the well and drank, and the noise was in the beast's belly like unto the questing of 30 couple hounds. But all the while the beast drank, there was no noise in the beast's belly. And therewith the beast departed with a great noise, whereof the king had great marvel.
Or we have the case, from a very different portion of the world, of an Arapaho girl of the North American plains. She spied a porcupine near a cottonwood tree. She tried to hit the animal, but it ran behind the tree and began to climb. The girl started after to catch it, but it continued just out of reach. "Well," she said, "I am climbing to catch the porcupine, for I want those quills, and if necessary, I will go to the top." The porcupine reached the top of the tree, but as she approached and was about to lay hands on it, the cottonwood tree suddenly lengthened, and the porcupine resumed his climb. Looking down, she saw her friends craning up at her and beckoning her to descend. But having passed under the influence of the porcupine, and fearful for the great distance between herself and the ground, she continued to mount the tree until she became the merest speck to those looking from below, and with the porcupine, she finally reached the sky. Two dreams will suffice to illustrate the spontaneous appearance of the figure of the herald in the psyche that is ripe for transformation. The first is the dream of a young man seeking the way to a new world orientation. "I am in a green land where many sheep are at pasture. It is the land of sheep. In the land of sheep stands an unknown woman and points the way." The second is the dream of a young girl whose girl companion has lately died of consumption. She is afraid that she may have the disease herself. "I was in a blossoming garden. The sun was just going down with a blood-red glow. Then there appeared before me a black, noble knight, who spoke to me with a very serious, deep, and frightening voice. 'Wilt thou go with me?' Without attending my answer, he took me by the hand and carried me away." Whether dream or myth, in these adventures there is an atmosphere of irresistible fascination about the figure that appears suddenly as guide, marking a new period, a new stage in the biography. That which has to be faced and is somehow profoundly familiar to the unconscious, though unknown, surprising, and even frightening to the conscious personality, makes itself known. And what formerly was meaningful may become strangely emptied of value. Like the world of the king's child, with the sudden disappearance into the well of the golden ball. Thereafter, even though the hero returns for a while to his familiar occupations, they may be found unfruitful. A series of signs of increasing force then will become visible, until, as in the following legend of the Four Signs, which is the most celebrated example of the call to adventure in the literature of the world, the summons can no longer be denied. The young prince, Gautama Shakyamuni, the future Buddha, had been protected by his father from all knowledge of age, sickness, death, or monkhood, lest he should be moved to thoughts of life renunciation. For it had been prophesied at his birth that he was to become either a world emperor or a Buddha. The king, prejudiced in favor of the royal vocation, provided his son with 3 palaces and 40,000 dancing girls to keep his mind attached to the world. But these only served to advance the inevitable. For while still relatively young, the youth exhausted for himself the fields of fleshly joy and became ripe for the other experience. The moment he was ready, the proper heralds automatically appeared.
Now, on a certain day, the future Buddha wished to go to the park and told his charioteer to make ready the chariot. Accordingly, the man brought out a sumptuous and elegant chariot, and, adorning it richly, he harnessed to it 4 state horses of the Sindhava breed, as white as the petals of the white lotus, and announced to the future Buddha that everything was ready. And the future Buddha mounted the chariot, which was like to a palace of the gods, and proceeded toward the park. "The time for the enlightenment of the Prince Siddhartha draweth nigh," thought the gods. "We must show him a sign." And they changed one of their number into a decrepit old man, broken-toothed, grey-haired, crooked and bent of body, leaning on a staff and trembling, and showed him to the future Buddha, but so that only he and the charioteer saw him. Then said the future Buddha to the charioteer, "Friend, pray, who is this man? Even his hair is not like that of other men." And when he heard the answer, he said, "Shame on birth, since to everyone that is born old age must come." And agitated in heart, he thereupon returned and ascended his palace. "Why has my son returned so quickly?" asked the king. "Sire, he has seen an old man," was the reply. "And because he has seen an old man, he is about to retire from the world." "Do you want to kill me that you say such things? Quickly, get ready some plays to be performed before my son. If we can but get him to enjoying pleasure, he will cease to think of retiring from the world." Then the king extended the guard to 1/2 league in each direction. Again, on a certain day, as the future Buddha was going to the park, he saw a diseased man whom the gods had fashioned. And having again made inquiry, he returned, agitated in heart, and ascended his palace. And the king made the same inquiry and gave the same order as before, and again, extending the guard, placed them for 3/4 of a league around. And again, on a certain day, as the future Buddha was going to the park, he saw a dead man whom the gods had fashioned. And having again made inquiry, he returned, agitated in heart, and ascended his palace. And the king made the same inquiry and gave the same orders as before, and again, extending the guard, placed them for 1 league around. And again, on a certain day, as the future Buddha was going to the park, he saw a monk, carefully and decently clad, whom the gods had fashioned. And he asked his charioteer, "Pray, who is this man?" "Sire, this is one who has retired from the world." And the charioteer thereupon proceeded to sound the praises of retirement from the world. The thought of retiring from the world was a pleasing one to the future Buddha.
This first stage of the mythological journey, which we have designated the call to adventure, signifies that destiny has summoned the hero and transferred his spiritual center of gravity from within the pale of his society to a zone unknown. This fateful region of both treasure and danger may be variously represented as a distant land, a forest, a kingdom underground, beneath the waves or above the sky, a secret island, lofty mountaintop, or profound dream state. But it is always a place of strangely fluid and polymorphous beings, unimaginable torments, superhuman deeds, and impossible delight. The hero can go forth of his own volition to accomplish the adventure, as did Theseus when he arrived in his father's city, Athens, and heard the horrible history of the Minotaur. Or he may be carried or sent abroad by some benign or malignant agent, as was Odysseus, driven about the Mediterranean by the winds of the angered god Poseidon. The adventure may begin as a mere blunder, as did that of the princess of the fairy tale, or still again, one may be only casually strolling, when some passing phenomenon catches the wandering eye and lures one away from the frequented paths of man. Examples might be multiplied ad infinitum from every corner of the world.
In the above section, and throughout the following pages, I have made no attempt to exhaust the evidence. Two have done so, after the manner, for example, of Fraser in The Golden Bough, would have enlarged my chapters prodigiously without making the main line of the monomyth any clearer. Instead, I am giving in each section a few striking examples from a number of widely scattered representative traditions. During the course of the work, I shift my sources gradually, so that the reader may savor the peculiar qualities of the various styles. By the time he comes to the last page, he will have reviewed an immense number of mythologies.